This is Encounters, a dialogue that brings you multifaceted life stories you don't want to miss.
I'm known to the general public in China as a film critic, but I actually pride myself on being an interpreter of cultural differences. And I aspire to be a creative writer. I wrote some plays and short stories, but I have not been taken seriously because of the image of being a film critic. Well, I'm not ashamed of being a film critic, but it's not the whole of me, it's just a part of me. Somehow I found it fascinating that writing gives you this opportunity to express yourself, even though critical writing is quite restrictive. You have to do everything within this framework. But then I found that you can, by picking the topics you want to criticize or you want to evaluate, assess, you're already expressing yourself. The way Roger Ebert approached the movie had a great impact on me. When he wrote about the film, he just watched this film and you could sense his passion. It's almost as if he were treating critical writing as a variation of creative writing. What he taught me was you write it for those people who are similar to you. So I'm a film lover. I write for people who also love films.
Hello and welcome to Encounters. I'm your host, Man Ling. Today I'm joined in the studio by Raymond Zhou. He's one of China's best-known film critics. Raymond started out writing reviews of Hollywood movies in the early 2000s, when he had a column on the hugely popular web platform, NetEase. His casual and witty style soon won him a loyal following. Over almost 20 years, Raymond has reviewed about 7,000 films, ranging from Oscar winners to little-known hidden gems, and he has been recognized for his insights by moviegoers and industry insiders alike. The Los Angeles Times once described him as the closest thing China has to a Roger Ebert. Fluent in both Mandarin and English, and passionate about art and literature, for 15 years, Raymond was a columnist and culture critic with China Daily, the country's only national English language newspaper. In this episode, Raymond tells us about how he became a critic and the role that his time living overseas had in shaping the distinctive writing style he has today. Stay tuned for more. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
And you're an old friend of mine because I've been reading articles of yours on China Daily for quite a few years.
Thank you.
And it's so difficult for me to introduce you. So I would give this job to yourself. How would you like to be introduced?
Well, I'm known to the general public in China as a film critic, but I actually pride myself on being an interpreter of cultural differences. And I aspire to be a creative writer.
That's your lifelong goal, right?
It's a goal I've been sporadically trying to achieve, but so far it has eluded me.
Really?
I wrote some plays and short stories, but I have not been taken seriously because of the image of being a film critic. So every time I'm introduced, the label film critic sticks on. There's no way I can peel it off. I tried for a couple of years and then I give up. Well, I'm not ashamed of being a film critic, but it's not the whole of me. It's just a part of me. And now that I think of it, you know, I kind of accepted myself, accepted the label, but still there are other parts of me that the public does not know or does not accept. When I say the public, it's not just the general readers. It's the people in this circle that I work with.
And back to when you said your aspiration is to become a creative writer or is striving to become one. Starting from when you find yourself obsessed with writing?
Well, when I'm in grad school in CNC University. three decades ago. I got a lot of assignments like all students. Somehow I found it fascinating that writing gives you this opportunity to express yourself, even though critical writing is quite restrictive. You have to do everything within this framework, and you have to learn this framework, the classical methods and the approaches. But then I found that you can, by picking the topics you want to criticize or you want to evaluate, assess, you're already expressing yourself. Well, why you like this genre instead of that one, this movie instead of that one. And after I became established as a film critic, I kind of, you know, got agitated and tried to break out of the mold, so to speak, because I feel that all these restrictions of critical writing become too restrictive. So I dabbled in creative writing. And actually, not just writing, I actually got into directing and producing on my plays. I was considered a dilettante, quite naturally. So gradually, I started to push it aside and to see it as a hobby. A lot of people have this vocation, a day job, and they have a hobby on the sideline, which probably really what they wanted to do. So I did not give myself like a task. I have to finish this on time. When I write a column, I have to do that because it's very
time demanding,
stipulated. But when you use it as a hobby, it gives you more freedom. Like you don't have to consider the market, the target audience. It's like I'm writing for myself, which is good and bad, of course. You know, you don't have a real audience, but you do something which is very, very pure.
But if you're writing under a time scheme or like assignments, homework assignments, or critical articles, reviews of movies has to be written in a certain sort of ways, these are the moments for you to hone your skills of writing, right? Mm-hmm. Go back to the Zhongshan University era when you discovered that you love writing, right? What was the first piece of writing you did, and what was that about, and how much pleasure you took from creating a piece of things that from nothing, which expresses your ideas in your mind?
Well, I stumbled upon the poems of Emily Dickinson while I was at Zhongshan University. At that time, the textbooks were only teaching American literature up to Walt Whitman. Emily Dickinson was not even included. And I found her to be so unique. So I started to write about her writing, the poems. And eventually I settled on her poetry as the topic of my master's dissertation. And when I think back, there's part of her that really resonated with me. But I'm not Emily Dickinson. If I decide to become a poet, I won't be patterning myself after her. So that's when it dawned on me that creative writing would give me more freedom, more latitude, a much bigger stage to express myself. The variations of creative writing is so much bigger because you are building something on nothing or on your life or your observations.
Uniquely yours.
Yes, but while for critical writing, you are building your writing on someone else's work.
Emily Dickinson expressed herself in poems, right? And you tried to understand it. And then you tried to understand and you thought you understood it. So you want to express yourself. Mm-hmm. You don't want to follow Emily Dickinson's footprints in writing her poems, but you're going to establish in the future. And you have already formed your own writing style in critical writing. Do you think this is a kind of try to understand other human beings and from them you try to define yourself?
Yes, exactly. But that was my formative years. And I think for most people, your formative years will give you exposure to the great wealth of literary giants and great artists all over the world. And that was the time when China just opened up and started the reform and opening up policy. And we were suddenly inundated with all this. You know, the floodgate was open and all those great literature came in. And most young people of my age, around 20 or 21, we were just so impressed with all these different people and different great writers and different writing styles. We didn't know. And quite randomly, you would pick one that happened to come into your view and thought that would be your goal, which is most probably not true, because later on I found out that it's not really beneficial that you become too identified with one writer or artist too early, because you want to form your own style, your own expressions, artistic expressions, and you will definitely stand on the shoulders of all the great predecessors who wrote or created before you. So by absorbing more, having more sources of inspiration, it will give you a more nuanced approach to the forming of your own style.
But going back, it's the opening up and economic reforms, the door open. The door open not only to economic reforms, I mean trades and commerce, it opens to literature and art. But is it a coincidence for you to choose the English major? If you don't choose the English language and English literature major, maybe you're going to just miss being a writer, or you're not going to live on writing.
Yes and no, because it was not me who picked the English major in high school. I was excelling in math. It was picked by the school administrator, who happened to be an English teacher. And he liked me so much that he picked it for me. I was 15. You know, I didn't know better. I liked all of the courses. I loved the Chinese language. I loved English. I loved math and physics, everything. And he picked that. But when I said not by coincidence, is I kind of swerved to another major after I got my master's degree in China. I got into the business school, a very good business school, University of California, Berkeley. It's still one of the top 10 business schools in the United States.
It was a detour.
Well, only later did I find that, yeah, it was a detour, because after I got my degree, I thought really hard for quite some time, do I want to get into business? It has obviously a great future in China, the kind of things that I got from
money-wise, especially.
Money-wise, and also in terms of the worldly pursuits, right? Mm-hmm. Then I decided that probably it was not for me. The kind of social interactions that I would be engaged in by nature.
Did you prove yourself that you can learn very well in class of business courses?
Yes. And later on, I found that I could be a strategist, but I don't really care much about management. Management would take certain kind of skills, especially people skills, that I don't have and I don't really think I will have. I will enjoy having. And
you are not investing your time in it.
Because when I observed my classmates, a lot of American young people, they're very sociable. The kind of ease that they have interacting with other people, people that they don't know, people that are totally different from them, really impressed me. And for me, that would be a big leap and something that I didn't have confidence in. So I thought what I really wanted was to create, not to do the same things again and again. And I discussed it with my family, so I decided not to pursue that. I came back to China. I got so many great opportunities, offers to get right into executive positions.
So it's the conceptual thinking in you that has led you to what you are today. Okay, what role did your parents play in choosing major and guiding you what to learn, what not to learn, or cultivate your interests?
Well, my parents did not play a very positive role. On the contrary, they usually play the villains.
They try to tame you. You were too wild.
They have a very different approach towards things. That's why I kind of developed independence in thinking. They did everything out of goodwill. They wanted
of course
only good for me. But, they can only think from their point of view.
Perspective.
Yeah, everyone has his or her own perspective.
So since you couldn't really get much from your parents, so the teachers would play a much bigger role in deciding what major or what direction you're going to take in the future.
I remember quite clearly that the only piece of great world literature that I got from before college was a short story by Anton Chekhov called Chameleon.
It's the Russian.
Yes, Serlong.
Yeah.
And I said my formative years was more or less during my undergraduate education, because first I was very young. I was still a teenager. I was 19 when I graduated. And I learned a lot from my classmates, who were much better educated, much better exposed to all those good influences. And of course, I learned from the textbooks and from the teachers, but those 4 years were very important to me. And it gave me systematic knowledge of the world outside in terms of culture and civilization.
Which university you entered? Hangzhou University. And then try to compare, because you mentioned in Hangzhou University, you're the youngest in the class.
Yes.
15 years old, right? Mm. How could the other students who are older than you have more exposures than you?
Well, first of all, they were mostly urbanites. They were from much bigger cities like Hangzhou. And they were whiling away. They were actually secretly reading up. Secret. They were reading up on the books that were not destroyed during the Cultural Revolution. Nowadays, there are movies about that, you know, people who were reading, even people who were
underground
watching.
Underground reading, can we say?
Yeah. There were also people who had access to foreign movies. That was mostly in Beijing, right?
Yeah.
So they had a much wider view of the world, while we, like, literally popped out of ignorance. We didn't know anything about the history of great civilization.
Blocked.
Yeah, we were blocked for 10 years. And even before that, the generation before me had very limited access. So nowadays, the young people cannot even imagine that a bookstore would become as crowded as we proverbially say in Chinese, 菜市场, a farmer's market, because it was jammed with people every day. And the shelves for world literature, you cannot imagine. It's like people were lining up.
It's like Christmas evening, you know.
Yes.
The people are just,
a shopping spree every day.
Yeah.
Whatever new titles appeared would be snatched up.
So hungry. People, like ordinary people, are totally blocked from 10 years. And that was the hunger drive you. Mm-hmm. I remember I graduated from Peking Normal University. I think the year is 1983. But in 83 or 82, the school decided to resume art department.
Wow.
Which has music. And I remember we have a very tiny, tiny old man carrying a huge tape recorder, because the department was going to be resumed and the students started to re-enroll in the next few years. Mm-hmm. But some selective courses to try to give students already on campus some knowledge about Western music, symphony. I remember him. And the largest classroom we had, even on windows, piles and piles of people. Mm-hmm. If you're late, you can never really get into it. But I was shocked when I first time heard a symphony, symphony number five.
Yes.
Yeah, of Beethoven.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. I was woken up. Mm-hmm. There are such beautiful sound that knocking into your soul right after. I mentioned the scene because I can never forget how that door of literature or art opened for us, this generation of people. So we understand why we become who we are today. Tell me that why you decided to go on learning. Because 1982, that was the year you graduated, right?
And I got to CNC University.
So many jobs. I know. I mean, so many jobs were waiting for you to pick up and make money and make a life. That time you were 19. But why you decided to go further study to Zhongshan University for graduate school?
Well, it never really occurred to me otherwise, because I kind of treated my undergrad years as high school. I skipped high school. Cumulatively, I had 3 years of middle school and high school. And the kind of things I were learning that were shaping me to most people would happen in high school. So naturally, I want to get to something better. And I didn't know, you know, I got to a better school in terms of ranking. And I didn't know that I actually got to like quite the elitist way of taking literature. It's kind of pushing me towards become a person in the academia. And that was the rigorous training that I inadvertently received and prepared me for becoming a critic in film and theater. I didn't know then. I could have, you know, there were so many job offers. Actually, at that time, there were not job offers that you were assigned a job.
Yeah.
But jobs were so literally floating everywhere.
Yeah.
Because there were so few college students, college graduates. And
for 10 years, we didn't have graduates from schools. Yes.
Yeah.
But the one thing is that you didn't have the pressure of making a living by yourself.
No, I strangely, you know, to young people nowadays, the living standard was still at that time quite low. It didn't take a lot of money to make a living.
But your parents were affluent enough or abundant enough to support you?
My parents, my family was, I'm from a small town, and we were not affluent, but we were not poor either. I guess my family was much better than those people from the countryside. Probably their children would have so much more pressure to not just make a living, but to repay whatever debt that they accrued. But for my family, we didn't borrow any money to tide me through. And I got some allowance from the school. I think I got like 20 yuan or 22 yuan a month, which was quite
a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah. So for the 4 years, my parents only shelled out, I remember, like 400 yuan. So I'm grateful for the country because the country chipped in much for, you know, it's free room, the food is very cheap, plus the allowance.
Tell our listeners how much is a normal dish cost?
Probably like 20 cents.
Cents,
yeah.
And then the first batch, when China went into later, you know, 10 or 20 years later, we universities are being expanded, right? And we recruit more students. That time, those who could enter universities are really elite.
Yes.
And the government was generous to give really good allowances.
Yes.
20 kwai.
Yeah.
That's a month's salary for an average worker then.
Slightly lower than
in Shanghai. My aunt received 28 kwai as a worker in a decent factory. So 20 or 30 kwai is the average monthly salary.
And it raised to 60 kwai when I got to graduate school.
3 years, right?
For the 3 years.
Yeah, yeah.
But then 60 kwai was quite a lot. But of course, that was like 4 years later and everything was rising. But still, I could live comfortably. And there's one sign I can share with my listeners. Every time I went to a bookstore, I never thought for a second that the books were too expensive. I like this book. I would buy it.
So you spend all your money on books?
Mostly books. And of course, books were very inexpensive, right?
Yes, yes.
So I remember the first complete Shakespeare came out. I didn't think twice before buying it. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, I would really hesitate buying a complete Shakespeare collection.
Yeah, yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
So different, right? Yeah. So after you graduated from Zhongshan University as a master degree, sort of in literature?
actually in literature, but the courses I took were more like culture, because I had a very, very wonderful teacher from London. She's actually German, and she had this course on civilization.
And then did you pick up a job after graduation in China?
Yes.
What sort of job was that?
I got into a job about cultural exchange, specialized in cultural exchange programs, specifically to take Chinese performing arts groups to Western countries, mostly North America.
You're still in Zhongshan or you come back to Beijing?
I came to Beijing, but I came to Beijing only for less than a year. And then I went to San Francisco.
Okay, which year you graduated from Zhongshan University?
85.
And then next year, 86?
86, yeah.
So you joined that company for just very briefly.
Yes.
What made you decide to, no, I'm not going to continue this job. I'm going to, you know.
No, actually, it was a continuation of my job in Beijing. I was still doing the same job in San Francisco. I was taking, I remember, the Oriental Song and Dance Group on a tour of North America. And there were many groups that I kind of functioned as a tour guide hyphen translator. So I was seen as the guy, the kid from school who could speak English and who knew something about art. And that kind of figured in this job, because it will require some knowledge of especially performing arts. And that actually shaped me, because I've always been fascinated with performing arts.
Why? Since when you were a little kid? As a kid, we had very little exposure to performing art.
Very, very little. Oh, the 8 model operas.
Yeah.
So that was it.
And then, like just now you said, you're obsessed now, right? Mm-hmm. You love performing art.
Yes.
Can you remember what time spot that you started to feel that, wow, I'm into it and this is the performing art? I mean, there are a lot of all kinds of arts in the world. And why performing art?
I don't think there was a moment of epiphany. I think it came gradually, just like the great literature and the great movies. Gradually, I absorbed something. It was inspired by this or that, and it formed in me that this was something that I really liked.
When was that? There's a time span. If it's not a particular piece of work or a performing art, but there must be several years or whatever.
I think it's the whole decade of the 1990s. I was spending like...
You already in the United States?
Yeah, I was spending like 2 or 3 years in New York. I was helping a friend with his business. Actually, that was the only years I was involved in business. Yeah, and
earning money, right?
Yeah, earning money, I hated it. I didn't even get pleasure while counting money. That's the time it really dawned on me that the job was not for me. Because for all the hard work, some people, like the small store keepers, they work really hard and they suffer through or endure all the grave things. But at the end of the day, when they were counting the profits they made, that would be the moment of relief and satisfaction, right? For me, it was not true. So that few years in New York was the time that I made a switch, because I was reading, I would subscribe to the New York Times and throw everything away, just keeping the culture and arts page. Oh. And I was reading that, but I could only afford to go to a few of the shows, partly about the time constraint and partly of money, because if you buy a full price ticket, it was quite expensive, but not expensive by today's standard.
Can I understand you in this way, that your first very brief job, that was for you to bring Chinese ensembles and performing art troupes to America or to other countries, that job led you, it's released you into a wild world of performing art, like Broadway, New York.
Yes.
And then you started to pay for shows, right?
Yeah, I
to watch them.
I went to quite several of them.
Movies?
Yeah, movies were cheap. And I was watching movies, but not in a systematic way. I just randomly picked something. Actually, it didn't really occur to me that I had the special thing for, say, criticizing movies. That came much later. That's come during the dot-com bubble around the turn of the century. But everything I did in the 1990s really prepared me for the person that I would become, turn out to be later, because the exposure I would have to the great shows on Broadway and the movies, and also the criticism in American media, like the reviews of New York Times and the film criticism of Roger Ebert. Later on in 2012, I think, Los Angeles Times called me China's Roger Ebert. And, you know, of course...
Do you think you live up to that honor?
Oh, that was, you know, I can only aspire to be half as good. But
that's a very good compliment. It's encouraging.
Definitely a compliment. But also, the most important thing is Roger Ebert was not elitist. He was writing for the general public. When I first started writing film criticism in China was very divisive.
Academic.
It was either academic or it was more like what we call xiaozi.
Bourgeoisie.
Yeah. It was not really reviews.
For the masses.
Yeah, it's either for a few young people or for those in the ivory tower. And I started write in a way for the mainstream media. For those people who are educated but not professionals.
Do you think this direction mm-hmm. was inspired by Roger Ebert?
Yes.
That's the similarity. Why yes. the Los Angeles Times compared you? The closest the China has is Raymond Zhou to Roger Ebert. There are similarities. That's why there must be a reason.
I consciously learned from him, I think, during a couple of years, between 2000 and 2005. Of course, I was reading critical writing, not just of Roger Ebert, but a lot of great critics.
He definitely caught your attention.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. the way he approached a movie had a great impact on me.
How did he approach a movie?
He would approach one from the position of a film lover, not from someone who wants to dissect a film or who want to write a scholarly work on this film.
Why it was important to write from the perspective of moviegoers instead of the others?
If you are in the academic circle, you have a job and you also have a certain writing style. It's not designated by you, but by the circle that you function in. But when Roger Ebert wrote about the film, he just watched this film and you could sense his passion. It's almost as if he were treating critical writing as a variation of creative writing.
Mm.
Because you had the right not to comment on it. Say, if I don't care about this movie, I just leave it alone.
Mm-hmm.
Either I really loved this one or hated it. Did I have enough incentive to express myself? So in that way, it's similar to creative writing.
So it's the love for the movie itself.
Yes. Or the hate.
Yeah, or the hate. But why write reviews for the masses?
What he taught me was you write it for those people who are similar to you. So I'm a film lover. I write for people who also love films. It's very difficult to write for professionals, say for the people who made this movie. They are professionals, right? So you kind of immerse yourself in a ton of jargons, in a pool of jargons, and in the kind of words that only they can understand, right? Or if you write for the general masses, people who don't know anything about films, it's also difficult. I'm not looking down on them. It's a different skill.
They don't understand.
They don't have the rudimentary skill. You have to think like, oh, if I mention the word Spielberg, I have to explain because the name is new to them, right? But if I write for film lovers, I don't need to explain the difference between Spielberg and Kubrick because those knowledge is taken for granted.
Over the years, Raymond has stuck to his principle of writing reviews from the viewpoint of a movie enthusiast and never hiding his love or hate for a movie. This approach has won him millions of followers on Weibo, where he's known by the nickname given to him by his fans, Zhou Lao Da, which literally means Big Boss Zhou. In our next episode, Raymond talks about the career of a film critic, how film criticism has evolved in China over the years, and the challenges his profession has faced due to the growing competition from amateur critics on social media. And that's the end of our show. I'm Manling. Thank you for joining me. Be sure to visit chinaplus.cri.cn and look for Encounters, where you will find other episodes of the show, along with Manling's journals about our interviews.